This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Let's go back to 2019.
In 2019, I was forgetful on little things, which was very out of my character. I give attention to detail and I pick up on the smaller detail, and I'd lost that. I was just thinking, geez, it's not like me to miss that, forget that. I was separated from my partner and got three kids. I'd put it down to the stress of that. And I've got my own retail business at the time. So navigating through the Brexit scenario and just like having a business and running that is quite challenging. So I'm going under a lot of stress at the moment. So it must be that. But I just carried on, just kept battling on. And I think that the thing that enabled me to carry on unnoticed, really, or people noticed it, but it wasn't, they weren't particularly scared about it, was the fact that the longer you do something, we are all a set of habits. Mm. And whatever those habits are, you are, whether they're good or bad or work related. So I continue to get up in the morning. My routine had been exactly the same for the previous 18.5 years. I get up, I go to the toilet, I make myself a drink, I brush my teeth with my right hand, you get in the car, you go to the same place of work, the same desk. So you could close your eyes and do them. Mm. And that's probably what kept me going for so long, because that I've got a very specific routine that I was doing. But I was just struggling in front of it. I was struggling to find the words. So the one thing you know with your own body is you know something's up. So I knew something was up, and I got through the Christmas of 2020 feeling out of sorts. And at the time, I liked to drink. I wasn't no more than anybody else. A couple of glasses of wine, but I'd stopped drinking. I'd stopped socializing. And I look back, you're like, that's not right. But that's what I'd do. And then I'd go to sleep and I'd wake up and just repeat. But I'd got a private doctor that I was aware of. And I went to see them in January of 21 and just explained how I'd been. They didn't really know me. They never really met me before. But I explained all the situation. Ordinarily, I'm fit and healthy and I get on with things, and I like to exercise and get out and about and things, and something's not right. And they did a bit of a check on me and didn't really see anything out of the ordinary. And so I said, look, I'm happy to pay, but I'd like to get all my bloods done and just have a health check. I said, Matt, maybe this is what happens when you get to 40. I was going to be 40 in May of 21. Maybe this is what happens when you get to this age. You know, people told me it gets a bit hard. So I had all my bloods done. I had a lot of tests done. And I'd picked my children up, and he'd rang me a couple of days later. He's like, I'm loud speaking. I was expecting the bad news. And I said, look, I've got my children in the car. Shall I call you back? And he was like, no, we've got your results. It's all good. You're really healthy. Everything was great. Yeah, you're fit and healthy. I was low on one thing, and I can't remember what it was. And he said, it doesn't really matter because you're so good on everything else that we're not really, but you might have just had a little bug or something like that at the time of the blood. He said, but you're absolutely fine. And I remember just thinking, Are you sure? And he went, yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely fit as a fiddle. I went, okay, wow. All right. That then just made me go,
is this how I'm going to live?
Well, this is what happened. Yeah, well, I just thought that it is. I'm getting older. That's it. Your body's getting older. Just get over it. And then I said, a few weeks from there, I declined a bit more and I was getting some dizzy spells. I was feeling very sick and nauseous all the time. I wasn't being sick, but I just felt sick. And again, I'm not somebody that is sick. Vomit or things like that. So that wasn't very nice. I went back to the same person and they diagnosed me originally with vertigo, which when you read about vertigo, which I'd never suffered with before, my initial reaction was I've jumped out of planes, I've climbed mountains, I don't mind heights. So I don't think I suffer with heights. It's like, well, it's not heights, it's where the crystals in your ear get dislodged. When he showed me these symptoms, I thought, well, actually, yeah, I do feel like that. And I wasn't having the very common symptom, which was really severe headaches for a long period of time. Are you getting headaches still? Not really. However, when I look back, I needed to be quiet a lot of the time, and I was in a fortunate position that I got my own business that was doing well, and I got staff and I could have time out. So I was often having lots of times and just very quiet and phone off, lights off. So looking back, I probably did have some headaches, but because I was managing to give myself a lot more love, a lot more care and quiet, so I was keeping that at bay. And I was due to my separation, I struggled mentally, and I'd actually got into, at the time, and I'd still do it every day now, but I got into meditation and just like your well-being. So I was doing a lot of that, and that was enabling me just to stay, you know, in a really calm and quiet sort of state. Going back to the illness, I was diagnosed with vertigo. I just carried on with that. I know they were giving me anti-sickness pills, and I don't really like taking medication. It can help it, but if you are in a position where you need it, then obviously it's important. So I was, and it just wasn't working. And no matter how many times I had this, the doctor, and he did it, I used to have an osteopath because I've got some old rugby injuries. So she would do it on me and I'd do it myself. And it just didn't work. It didn't matter how many times I did this maneuver, it didn't work. And I was thinking, okay, that's it. And I just carried on and on to the point where I then did start to, I was losing my balance. I was struggling to feed myself. And when I say struggling to feed myself, if I tried to get my cereal bowl, the spoon from the bowl to my mouth, I would completely miss, hit my chin, hit my neck, it all fall out of me. So I'd actually have to grab the bowl and put my head on it and actually sip the milk and cereal. And even then I'd miss somehow. And I'd just laugh it off. I'd just go, and that just got to a point where if I was walking, I'd lost my sort of sense of gravity, if you like, as we're sat here now. Well, I sort of said to you, look, close your eyes, and you did it, and all of you can do it, you close your eyes, you can visualize yourself sat there. You're aware of your spatial awareness, that you're sat in a chair on earth in your room, and the sun's out there. I'd lost all that. I'd got no concept of my human body on this planet. You've got no spatial awareness, so it's just complete. I said, you just fall over. Mm-hmm. So if I close my eyes, I'd just fall. So that was scary, and that's when I started thinking, this is quite serious. So I think you might need to go and get a second opinion. And then I just carried on. And my scaredness deep down went, oh, the alpha, no, come on, you're fine. Come on, up you go and keep going. And all that sort of, not, it's good in one way because I kept going, but equally I knew something was up. At this point, I was getting excruciating pain in the head. And it was more like a buildup of pressure. So it was like, basically, if I could have got something to like stick like a needle into my brain just to release the pressure, that's how it felt. And I was like, really need to just release it. So I was at that point and I'd been there for a couple of weeks, really. I'd been ex-rugby, I'd the martial arts, I'd broken lots of parts of my body over the years and had them fit. Previous to that, a few years before that, I was actually involved in a car accident where I was the cushion between a lorry and a car, and I shouldn't be here then. Because I crushed my pelvis and my shoulder and my top of my spine. And I can assure you it was a very excruciating experience. So I got a high pain threshold and I'd never felt pain like it in the head at this point. I actually remember thinking to myself, and it was a flippant thought, I'd rather be dead. So I just remember thinking that when you're at that point, there's a problem.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a bit more than a migraine. I felt like I was going to vomit 24/7.
Yeah.
So I felt it the whole time. I'm going to be sick. But I just never was actually sick.
At the time, you wrote letters for your children, for their 18th and 21st birthday. And that was a lovely idea.
At the beginning of this, I didn't know it was a benign tumor. They said that we're hoping that it will be. But obviously, until they cut you open
send it off for tests.
Do an autopsy. Mm. They don't know. Mm. So they were saying, look, it's looking like it is going to be that way from our understanding, but we can't be sure. So I was very pragmatic with it. So I'm like, okay, right, now we know what it is. Great. It was a lot worse than I thought it was. Right, now how do we fix it? How are we going to sort this out? Because I'm not going anywhere. So you do all that thinking. And then basically what happened was, I got diagnosed on the Monday. They scanned me on the Tuesday. They were going to operate me on the Wednesday. And then there'd actually been an outbreak of Novavirus at the QE hospital. Oh. Basically, my operation went back. So they get me ready on the Wednesday. Didn't happen. Got me ready on the Thursday. Didn't happen. Got me ready on the Friday, which was my 40th birthday. So I thought, definitely going to be today, but it wasn't. And so it went on for a couple of weeks. So I had a couple of weeks of thinking about things and then going, what happens if I don't? Well, I might not make it. The more you spoke to people, the more you spoke to the surgeon. Like, everything should be good, but, and there is a but, you know, there is a chance that the worst thing could happen. You might not be here or you're not the same again. You have to learn to walk and talk again, and you can't ever get back to where you were before. And so you just start thinking about all these things. So I just wanted to make sure that if I wasn't here, or if I wasn't the version that I am now talking to you, or the, which is the version that I was before, then I wanted to leave something for my kids. So yeah, my sister recorded me, and my brother did, and I did some like videos for their 18th, their 21st. I've kept them, and I haven't been able to watch them since, because I just remember doing them at the same time. Yeah. I've got tears in my eyes now, and I've got even more tears back then.
That's lovely. So I wanted to say it to you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And that will probably lead on, ironically, to my eldest child, Millie, is 13 years of age. And she recently, she's at high school, and she recently had some homework assignment in one of her topics. And the teacher had said to everybody, I wanted to write about somebody that's been an inspiration to you.
And don't, she mentioned said before, to
I'm not.
Oh.
Yeah, so she's written this essay on me being her inspiration, and she's put pictures associated with it, because as you saw with the research, you know, I've been in paper, newspapers, and been on radio. So she'd used these articles and written this lovely thing on me and sent it to me a couple of days ago, just saying that I just wanted to share this with you. I've done this for school homework, and I'm really proud of you. But she wears a heart on her sleeve, so she's very much, you know, got a lot of character attributes that are mine. And so we don't really, you know, she'll just get over things, and I'll get over things. I'm one of them people. So we've talked a bit about it over the years, but more so with my younger two. But she does, she's like, oh, don't worry about it. You're good now. And yeah, no, it's all really good. So don't worry, you know, I'm fine. So for her to send me something and see it from her own words that I've been the inspiration to her, that was just like, I felt like I cracked it. If it could have put a big tick across me. Mm. And I was like, you are my reason. My three children are my reason to keep going and to keep fighting. And after the surgery, the bit they don't tell you is that it's a tough journey. I have to learn to walk and talk properly again. And you're slower and you're not as fit. And I was on my own. I hadn't got anybody living with me because I was separate. And they were my focus. I just kept thinking, I've got to get back to them. Yeah. You've got to be your best version. And I just kept going. So for her to have understood that and actually articulated it in some homework, and I was like, yeah. So after the surgery, I said to my surgeon, what is the quickest way for me to get from A to B? And what I mean by that is, currently I'm on a intensive care bed with tubes coming out of me. How do I get from this position to the position I was before, where I didn't have tubes coming out of me, as quick as I can? I said, because I'll be out of here tomorrow. My mindset was very much, I'll be out of here tomorrow. I'm going to get out. And he went, look, if you can avoid caffeine and alcohol for a few months, that would really help. And I was like, fine. And he said, you've got the mindset. Just keep going. Just listen to your body and just feed yourself with the right things. I'd always been conscious of bettering myself, but again, I'm no saint. And I like my wine. I like my beer. I said, I played rugby, and so I got a high tolerance level. I'd dabbled in lots of things over the years and got the t-shirt. And I at the time, my sort of go-to was, I loved black Italian coffee. I haven't touched caffeine since. That was over 2.5 years ago. And I only recently, in the last sort of few months, if I want to get from A to B, then I've got to go all in. So I'm all in. And I'll probably be one of them people anyway, but I just had to be 100% all in. Because I have to be the best version for me, for my children, for my family, and for my future self. I wanted a much better existence. I wanted to make sure that this was never going to happen again. I was out of the hospital 2.5 days later, which was unheard of.
Yeah, wow.
You know, when the surgeon, I said to him, when I went down and had my, when they put the, you know, the anaesthetist put the thing, and I said to him, I said, what's the quickest somebody in my position has been out of hospital out here? And they went, I actually think it was about 17. I think they said, well, intensive care, possibly anywhere between 5 and 10 days. And then I think it's about 7 to 10 days in the room. So probably about 14, 15 days. Mm. I said, put my name above there. I said, because I'll be out of here tomorrow. And they went, well, with an attitude like that, yeah, I don't put anything past you.
Yeah.
And they then the next thing, they gave me the jab and I'm gone. And when I came round on the intensive care, I had, again, it was COVID, you couldn't have any visitors now, but intensive care, and I've got my own nurse, and she's looking at me and everything, and I couldn't really move. I could feel everything, could speak, As I ran my brother and I ran my friend, I can just put hello. You're high on life, aren't you? And high on anesthetic and all that sort of stuff. And anyway, I turned around to the on-call doctor there and he said, you're going to be in here for a few days. I'm going to be out of here tomorrow. I've told you all this. He was like, okay, doctor, you've got a great attitude and that's really good. He said, I just want to meet your expectations. I said, that's great. You can say all those things, but I'm telling you, I'll be out of here tomorrow. Anyway, he turned around and he gave me a load of sedatives and a load of everything. But right, you need a big sleep now. And I said, I'm not going to sleep. Just so you know, I meditate. I said, so I'm going to spend, I said, how long are you going to be gone for? He said, I'm going to be gone for 12 hours. I said, great. So by the time you come back, I'll have meditated to every part of my body and it'll be able to move. And then I'll be ready to go. I said, so if you could just get in line when you come back, can you just make sure whoever I need to see to get signed off, I'll be ready. And he started to give me this warm smile and he went, he said, I meditate as well. He said, fair play. He said, well, that's really going to help. Anyway, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, yeah, give it a little squeeze. Fair play to you. I'll see you in 12 hours. And he walked off and he then whispered to the nurse. Anyway, he goes. And I've sat there for 12 hours and I meditated to every part of my body, to my eyelids, to my every strand on my hair, to every private part, everything. And until I could feel, I moved my little toe, my big toe. I just put all my energy and attention to that. And he comes back 12 hours later and he should have walked over. And he looked at me, hello, Mr. Elmore, how are you? Yeah, very good, thank you. He said, how was your sleep? I said, I didn't sleep. And he went, he smiled again. He looked at the nurse. He went, did Mr. Elmore get any sleep? And she went, not a wink. He went, very well. And he said, and the monitor, has it remained like that the whole time? She went, absolutely. And he went, Mr. Elmore, how do you feel? I said, I can move everything. And he went, come on. He went, I went, I can move everything, look. And I moved my feet, my toe, and he went, wow. He said, wow, I'm amazing. And then he looked at the nurse and he went, I'm interested. Did you give him that other bit? So she went, absolutely. And he whispered it again. I said, what was that? And he said, I gave you enough sedative last night, put the whole hospital to sleep. He said, but just in case you can get to sleep, I also gave the nurse some extra to give. And I said, there's no way you're going to use it. And she used it and you still didn't fall asleep. He said, whatever you did in this last 12 hours, it has worked. He said, well, I'm in astonishment. Well done. And I said, that's all lovely. Great. Now what do I need to do? And he went, well, I'd like to get out of it. And he said, I need to get the physio over. I said, brilliant, get the physio over. And so the physio came over and I said, what do I need to do? So you need to walk 50 steps to get to the toilet and use it. I mean, brilliant. And at that stage, my vision wasn't great. And I remember saying to him, look, can you just keep close to me? I said, because I can walk, but I can't quite see where I'm going. I was blurry and I did. And then they got me out of there into the ward. And then my surgeon couldn't wait to see me. Because again, he was a godly man. And we talked about hospital that got diagnosed. My surgeon, Ismail Chalvaraja, he's come into my room. So I'm just going back a little bit here. So I've gone in on the Monday, scan my brain on the Tuesday. Tuesday afternoon, he comes in. I've never met him. I'm in my room on my own. I've realized this has all got a bit more serious than I thought, than vertigo. I've got the headphones on. I'm meditating. I'm actually doing a meditation on tumors in the body and healing yourself from within with a guy called Dr. Joe Dispenza, which is also a very good book for you to read. So Dr. Joe Dispenza and human being, and again, scientifically has now proven that we are destined. If you believe in God as I do and you believe in the creator, then you must understand that we're formed in his own image. So we are godly in our own right in the fact that we are super beings. And if you can connect back into that, you can heal yourself from lots of illnesses by doing the cold and eating right and thinking right. You can make sure that your own immune system is ready to fight any illness that comes along, whether it be COVID or any other sort of common that you are designed to deal with them. So you could tap back into your own resources by connecting them with your body. So I was very on that journey and I was doing meditations on healing your body from within with tumors, not knowing that I've got a tumor. So he comes in, my surgeon, Ismail Chalvaraja, and I didn't mean to interrupt your music. So I'm actually meditating. Oh, wow. I said, I meditate. What are you meditating on? I said, you wouldn't know him if I talked to you. You'd probably think I'm a bit daft. Try me. I said, oh, his name's Dr. Joe Dispenza. He went, oh, he's a genius. What a genius he is. And I went, oh, wow, you know about it. He said, he's unbelievable. He said, what are you doing it on? I said, tumors in the body, healing your body from tumors inside. I said, and he looked at me just stopped in his tracks and he went, are you a surgeon? And I went, no, why? And he went, I might as well let you strike because you're already 99% of the way there of hurting yourself. He said, you've got a brain tumor on the cerebellum of your brain. And I went, oh, amazing. I said, oh, what next? And he went, I'm going to operate on you in the morning. First thing, we've got to cut it out immediately. We can't give you chemo or anything like that. We've got to get it out of your body. He said, it's going to be good. We're going to sort it. I went, brilliant. And he went, and the fact that you're already meditating on healing your body, you said the way there. And I said to him, I said, well, the time you operate on me in the morning, I'll have either healed it or it'll be the best it's ever been, like the operation, the best it ever got. Anyway, as you know from my previous chapter, I didn't ever get operated on for a couple of weeks. And when I said to him that bit where you're sending me home to die, when I, no, I'm not sending you home to die, you're a great guy, you're going to be fine. And I said, brilliant. And I reiterated, I said, by the time I come back, I'll have either healed it or it'll be the best it ever went. It was the latter. And he couldn't wait to come into my room 2 days later, and he smiling from ear to ear, and he went, Marcus, it couldn't have gone any better. He said, honestly, he said, I've got two understudies with me, and I stopped them doing what they were doing. I said, come and look at this. He said, when I cut the back of your head open, he said, like that, what the he said, my concern was never the tumor, it was always getting to it. There's more implications getting to it in this day and age, in this modern day and age, the technology they got. I don't know what it was like 10, 15 years ago for you or anything like that. So there's more, especially the back of your brain, there's more complications getting to you. You've got all your spinal cords, you've got everything than he's actually getting to the tumor bit. He said, when I cut you open, all your sort of spinal cord, it almost moved to the side. He said, I've never seen anything like it. And I said to him, he said, two understudies, I said, come and look at this. He said, you'll never see that again. He said, we were in and out within three hours and 15 minutes. It was supposed to be a 6 to 8 hour operation. And he said, I've never, and he said, when I got into your skull, so again, yours was brain, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mine was a meningioma.
So, okay. Because they had to cut some of my skull out to get in. And more often than not, they can't put the bone back in the brain because the brain swells and they have to put it in your stomach. Because the acid's in your stomach, they can't replicate it. So he said, if you wake up with a little scar on the side, because we put the bone in there, and then you've got this snorkel that hangs out your brain where they're dripping the fluid off. And then in about 4 to 6 weeks' time, once the swelling's gone down, we'll put the bone back in. And that was very common, apparently. And that unfortunately didn't happen for me. But he said, should I cut your head open, got in, and he said, your tumor was like, sticking up on the shelf bit of your head.
Just take me.
He said, exactly. He said, literally, it was like literally going, take me. Yeah. I shouldn't be here. And he said, I'd literally, because often they have to push the brain out and move things and they wake you up, don't they, to check which bits of it. He said, it's like your brain has pushed itself down, the tumor pushes itself. I was like, it was just in and out, but like he said, I've never seen anything like it. And he was so joyful to come and tell. He was so like elated, but he was like, and I went, what does that mean? I'm in this ward. What does it mean? He went, you're going to be fine. That's what that means. And he went, all we're waiting for now is just to check it's benign. And literally, as he said that, he got a text on the screen. He went, oh, your results have just got on. Bang. And it's benign. Oh. Like this, and I was like, what does that mean? He went, it's all good.
Go home. Yeah.
Yeah. Three of the guys, old boys were in there, and they're like, yeah, well done. No, because they were just lovely people. And the one guy was Muhammad from the mountains, and he was a lovely gospel man as well. And I broke the cultural difference in the room down, and we were all having this lovely chat. And they just went, we're so glad you've had that news. And it was just such an amazing moment. And yeah. I've got to say that to you and share it with you, because I feel in amongst everything that I have been really fortunate in being unfortunate. Mm. And I put that down to, I feel like the creator's got a different plan for me. That I said to you before, 10 years ago, I got run over and I was told by every doctor that I should be dead, and I'm not.
How long was it until you were feeling a bit more yourself?
The next few months, just reinventing myself to the best that I could. The steroids they put you on, I was really big. And because of obviously that they couldn't get me into a few weeks, the steroids were doing two things. They were, one, keeping me alive and stopping the tumor growing any bigger. But they also made me put about 3 stone on in about 4 weeks.
Yeah, I had the same. Oh, it looked
become
ridiculous.
Become like a pack man or pack woman, where you just can't you can't be satisfied. I said to him, and I said, like, I could have eaten everything and he could just keep bringing it to me and I just keep eating. There was no satisfaction. But you don't care.
There's nothing you can do.
Like, I'm alive, so keep going. And I said my 40th birthday, so I was in hospital and it didn't happen. And then they were, we can't get you in for a couple of weeks, so we're going to give you loads of drugs to get you going and medicos to get you going. And my sister did her 40th birthday for me at her house with my family. And she cooked my favourite chilli dip, which was a roast dinner, roast beef. And I ate mine. There was probably 12 of us there. I had everybody's leftovers. She'd ordered them. I had three roast dinners myself. Went on to eat everybody's leftovers. And then had pudding. My mum loved making this great cake, baker. And so she made me my favourite. I liked eating that. And I remember turning around to my dad. I said, Dad, you need to take me home. I'm going to eat the house. I'm going to start eating you lot. So I left. Obviously, you're in a lot of pain and things. So I wanted to go anyway because I just think be quiet. It was a lot of noise. And
did you find you were angry? Did you get any sort of like your emotions and stuff when you were on the steroids? Because when I was on steroids, I was snappy and I was like quite, and I just think my parents were like, oh my gosh, when is she going to be off these? I don't remember that. I don't have any memory of being like that.
You're right. I think what you do. So there was two sides to it. I was doing lots of things to keep me very calm and stable. But on the steroids, you turn into a crazed 100 million mile an hour. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a very short, very to the point. I don't recall most of it, but I know I was very, somebody asked me a question, it annoyed you. You know, you get angry quite quick, you're quite annoyed.
Yeah.
And you'd be very short and you'd be very to the point and say things that, and I can't specifically remember things that I said to recount now, but I just know that I hurt people's feelings. So, yeah, so I'm glad. I wouldn't recommend, you know, steroids to anybody. They did their job for me. And obviously at a different time, I would have gone in to the hospital, I'd have been diagnosed and I'd have been operated on the next day. And therefore there wouldn't have been any need for the amount of steroids and the level of steroids I was on. But as I say, it's not a problem because it all worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
I'm healthy, I'm happy, I'm alive and everything went really well. So the fact I had to go on steroids for a few weeks and do some silly things and offended a few people, it was all reversible and redeemable. There's nothing that was lasting.
So you've had the surgery, you've had that removed and you've done some recovery. Did you have any long-lasting problems?
No, I've been really fortunate, Claire, and I've been fine. And I say fine because I'm one of them people who goes, hey, it's all fine. But it's a continual journey. I'm over 2.5 years on. I've done everything correct that you can do.
So when was it you started doing the fundraising? So you were feeling a bit better, your body's feeling a lot stronger. When did you start doing the fundraising?
Friend is a coach in the personal development world. And in the November of the 21, I started getting back to the gym. He'd rang me all the way through and said, look, what can I do for you? And I said, when I'm ready, get me fit, get my body fit again, and fitter than it's ever been. They went, brother, I can do that for you. So I got to the November of the 21. I'd done a lot of just little bits of walking myself and just bit by bit building myself back up, building my strength back up, building my mental well-being back up. And I wasn't fixed by any stretch, but I was in the right direction. And I rang him and said, look, I think I'm ready. And he went, okay, what level are you at? I said, I don't know. He went, all right, come down. So he did some one-on-one with me. And the very first day I went to the gym, he put the little box out. It was about 6 inches high and said, step up on that. And it took me about 10 minutes to get my foot up one and get the other one on and get back down. But somehow I did it. And, you know, every day I just went in, I just kept being consistent, kept like eating the right things, not drinking, meditating, just doing all the right things that you can do. And we got to the sort of jammed bed of that of 22. And he said, he'd been doing one-on-one with me. And he said, I think tomorrow, I went, yeah, he went, do you want to come into the clap? And I was like, what, with everybody else? And he went, yeah, with everybody else. And I went, oh, right. I said, oh, are we done? Like, are you finished with me? He went, no. He said, you ready? And I was like, what do you mean? He went, you ready? He said, you've got yourself to a position now where some people that are coming are at your level. Some are not as good. Some are better. He said, you ready to come to the class? So I did. And I just turned up every day. And I was the very first. I felt like an alien. I felt really distant. I felt like everybody was looking at my big scar in the back of my head. I was really conscious of it. I was depleted as a human being. I was as low as you could be, but I was also so happy to be there as well. I'm like, I'm here, so just keep going. And that's when I started delving into charities and I found Brad Gilla Research. So it was about the, I think it was about the March time, March, April. I thought, okay, well, what can we do? And then I was chatting away and I chatted to my friends and I'd been through there. My best friend who's got the gym and another one, she'd actually passed away and she got, she was involved in a tragic bike accident. So we were all helping each other out mentally and physically and on a daily basis. And we still do. We've got a little private WhatsApp group. There's 5 sort of alpha males on it. And we talk about meditating and cold water therapy and breathing exercises and eating right things. We just check in with each other. We're there for each other. We did a global fitness competition, which is about 1.5 hours long, 1 kilometer runs. And then in between each kilometer run, there's a physical endurance activity as well. So you're sled pushing 175K over 100 meters. Mm. You're pulling in, you're doing wall balls, you're rowing, there's lots of different things. So on that particular day, so last year we did it. We've really done it again this year. So yeah, the chap that's with me, Jason, the guy that I'm talking about, Paul, he's the one who's got like an army. He decided because he's just an absolute machine that he was going to do it with a 10K army vest on because he's ex-army, just because he can. But yeah, so that's the chap I'm speaking about there. And going back to what you're saying, is that we helped each other out. And then I decided, well, let's raise some awareness, let's raise some money. And it's just progressed from then. Well, I decided that we'd do the national Three Peaks in another 24 hours, which we did in October of 22.
That's a lot quicker than normal, isn't it? Just am I getting that right? That's a lot faster than the majority of people, isn't it? That's very quick.
I mean, it's literally, look, if you get, most people would just do like a mountain in one day. To scale up a mountain, it's like an average person to go walking up a mountain and back down, who's done no sort of training at all. We'd probably take about 4.5, 5 hours, something like that. So it's, and that's if you, yeah, I'd say you'd have to be relatively fit to do that. So, yeah, we decided that we were going to do three. So you've got Ben Nevis in Scotland, got Scarfell Pike in the Lake District, and then you finish off with Snowdonia in Wales. And you do it in 24 hours. So you've got a minibus driver and there's no sleep. You get a little bit of sleep in the minibus, like 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes in here. And I wanted to show people, and more importantly, myself and my children, and anybody else that was suffering with a brain tumor or any life-threatening illness, that you get your mindset right and you get your body, you can achieve anything. Don't just think because you've been diagnosed with this life-changing illness that you can't go and live again, because you can. And not only was I going to live, I wanted to thrive. I wanted to show people that you can thrive through this. It just escalated. Then I was just getting fitter. There was a few people in the gym that were talking about this Hyrox thing, and I hadn't really heard about it before. And I was like, okay, well, what's this Hyrox thing? And then they told me, and I was like, well, that sounds pretty brutal. I just didn't explore it any further. And then a couple of people in the gym went, I think you should do the Hyrox. You know, you could do it. And I was like, do you think? Yeah, but you've got the mindset, you're fit. And I was like, oh, okay, let's try a little look at it and let's do it. I've got three kids, so let's do three events. So we did in October of 22, we did the National Three Peaks in under 24 hours. And then we did the Hyrox the weekend after. And then I did the Birmingham Half Marathon the weekend after that. So I just took it like anything. If I'm going to do it, I was going to do it. So the reason we picked the Three Peaks, it's actually my girlfriend's like idea. She was like, why don't you do the Three Peaks? Because there's three mades and you could name like each. I was like, oh, that's perfect. What a great idea. My friend Paul, who I mentioned to, he got in touch with Hyrox, who are a global competition, and mentioned my story to them. And they actually flew out their film crew and they did a documentary on me that went out to 47 countries across the world. And they actually got me to open the world final championship was at Manchester Arena. And by social media channel, which is my Instagram's rewired_Marcus. It's got all the stuff that I've been doing on there.
When did you start doing the meditation and mindfulness?
So having gone through my separation, I started that in, I got to about Christmas. I separated in October 2019 and I got to the Christmas of 2019. And like many people, I was drinking lots because I was trying to numb the pain of the separation. And I got to Christmas and I was done. I was mentally done. I'd had a retail business that, as I said to you earlier, which I've gone through Brexit up and down, it was really stressful. I brought my business partner, that was my brother, and we'd had a long-standing working relationship. We're very close, and so we're going through all the dynamic and demographic of that. And I was just done. I remember being in my car thinking, I could quite easily just push my foot down all the way and drive off a cliff. I was at that point, and I started having empathy for people that took their own life. My cousin had recently done it, unfortunately. At the time, if you like, literally at the same time, I'd separated. And I always used to think, it was actually, I think the year before, I always think, oh, selfish act. I can't believe somebody's done that. Now, what a coward. And then when I was there myself and I had empathy for it, I was like,
I understand.
I get it. Yeah. I really get it. And it was at that point, I was in a lot of pain mentally. And I remember driving home from work and coming back home, and I thought, you've got to change this. You can't keep living like this. You cannot have this mindset, because this isn't how life's supposed to be. When you start thinking about taking your own life, and when you start thinking about like horrible things like that, it leads on to just being in a very negative mindset, a negative mind frame. You're emitting negativity. It's not the way to be. And I thought, I can either go and commit it and do that, or find the path that gets you out of that. And that's when I started. Fortunately, I went for that option, and I just started studying. And I went, Joe, I'm going to back off the drinking, because I could also see if you just carried on drinking, you're going to end up down this slippery slope of living in that bracket. And I was like, I'm not going to be that person. Three kids, beautiful kids. Come on, let's be your best. Let's do it. And I just started reading about what other people were doing. I was reading about the elites, whether it was in sport, whether it was in business, whether it was in whatever element you were. I was just looking at the best of the best in that industry. They go, what do you do? And I read about them, and I read and all of them, bar none really. I can't think of any one that I read. And I'll give you an example. Somebody like, I read Djokovic's book. I read about Elon Musk. Whether you like them or loathe these people, they're at the top of their game. I read about Ronaldo, Beckham, Ronnie O'Sullivan, just anybody. I just thought, well, who's the top of, what are you doing? What did you do? And I guarantee you, none of them were going out getting smashed every night. None of them, golfers, Tiger Woods, what were you doing? They got a really strict, disciplined routine. It wasn't a fluke that they were at the top of the game. No, you've got to have some talent. I'm not taking that away from anybody. But you've got to have discipline, desire, and you've got to be really intentional about how you go about things. And if you want to be your best version, all of them have got some time without having time out. They were having some cold therapy, hot therapy, they were mindfulness. So all of them had got this, and I was like, okay, great. That's written about Tony Robbins and all these sort of personal, I did a very big personal development journey on myself and went, okay, this is going to be new. Let's go for it. When I first started meditating, it was like, what the f*** am I doing? What a load of mumbo jumbo this is. Well, this is ridiculous, because you're so used to not doing that, because you are a set of whatever circumstances that you are at that point, whatever habits you've got, you are. And I went, this is a load of rubbish, but I went, no, come on, this is what they're doing. You're trying to work out how they're at the top. This is it. So I just got into it, and it probably took about 3 months, and the light bulb just clicked, and I went, I just got it. Where I have a cold barrel every day, every morning, between 3 and 6 minutes on my balcony, and I can hear my owl in the distance hooting. And it is, so my morning routine, and it came from reading Wim Hof's book, and then amalgamating it over with stuff that I was doing, things like that. So I got a very strict routine in the morning, and it consists of 3 rounds of Wim Hof breathing, which is sort of 30 deep breaths in through the nose and in through the mouth into the belly. And on the last one, you let that go. And you hold that for as long as you can. And it's usually between about 2, 2.5 minutes. You'd be amazed at how quick you can get up to holding your breath. And I do three, and then you do, and then you breathe in, hold it for 15 seconds, and you repeat that for 3 rounds. And that takes about eight minutes. And that just calms the mind, calms the body, gets all the acidity out of your body, and replaces it with pure oxygen, which opens up the blood vessels in your body, your brain vessels, your heart vessel, everything. Just gets the blood flowing around your whole body. Makes you just feel, just charges you, resets you and charges you. So it's a great start to the day. I used to wake up with anxiety and stress and No, I don't. And I do that immediately. I then do some meditation. I do a 10-minute mindfulness meditation. And, you know, that could be a one that you're listening to, like karma. And as you get on with it, you understand that you can then meditate. You don't need a karma. You know, you just meditate yourself. Might be just with a bit of music. And then I do a little flow routine. So I do some stretching and some exercise, some sit-ups, press-ups. I also do two other things with that. I do a plank hold for as long as I can. And then I finish it with a headstand. And the reason why I finish it with a headstand is obviously having a brain tumor, I was trying to get my blood back into my head. So once I felt comfortable enough, it was about 6-7 months afterwards, I started getting my body upside down. So I'd be trying to do handstands and things like that. And now I could just do a headstand. I could do handstands. I could do walking handstands, just the nature of my training that I do. And I just smiled. The reason why I've maintained that there, so the plank, the headstand and the cold and the breathing, they're my non-negotiables. And I do the headstand every morning and I smile to myself. I laugh. I think 42 years of age, I had a brain tumor. I've got a 10-inch scar at the back of my head and I can do a headstand and it just makes me laugh. So I do that for that reason. And it brings a lot of blood into the head and everything as well. So just makes me rejuvenated. And after that, I go and sit in the cold tub for 3 to 6 minutes.
Oh, it's working. It sounds like.
It is. I recommend it to everybody. I know it might sound bizarre, but again, if you go back to our ancestors being on this planet, did they have hot running water? No. They had cold rivers and streams and springs, and they ate natural food that was home, that was organic, that was grown on the planet, grown out of the ground, and it didn't have loads of chemicals over it. And they thrived. So look, it's a case of getting back to what I mean by that is it's lovely to have hot water. And I'm not suggesting after I've done all the cold and after I've worked out, I also go to the gym after that as well. I do my cold before training. I then have a really nice hot shower and I put nice warm clothes on and I've got the heating on now. So it's not like I walk around in the cold, search for the cold. You need both. The key to this is you are designed to have cold, designed to have heat. You need both. So it's important to search both and the health benefits of cold water submersion or cold water therapy. I shouldn't say submersion because you put your head in it for just briefly, but you want your head above the cold water. Is go and do your research. It's scientifically proven to have, it lowers your cholesterol, it lowers your heart rate, it lowers your stress levels. It creates endorphins, serotonin levels. So the hit that you get off the cold therapy after you've done these other bits, if you're liking it to somebody who snorts cocaine, takes cocaine, they get a hit and it lasts 6 to 9 minutes. Going in the cold water, it the equivalent of that, but 100 times stronger, and it lasts anywhere from 4 to 6 hours. So it's a natural high that gives you this amazing feeling and just sets you up for the day. Mm. And if you've got loads of crap going on, like lots of people have, like most of us have, stress, anxiety, and the fear, and it resets that and just makes everything much more manageable and just sets you up to be a better version of yourself to cope with things. So they're more non-negotiables and I will do them to the day that the big fella decides that it is my time. And so far it's not now. So, so I feel very blessed for that. It's just about conscious being aware of that. So the other two bits, the meditation, the mindset, you know, the meditation, the cold water and the breathing and the movement, they're all free. Crib Gok in Wales, and I have to be mispronounced it a few times, and I'm sure you can understand the word that gets misrepresented with. And it's a really tough challenge. It's a really tough climb, and we're going to do that in our brain tumor research center with a couple of friends that I've mentioned to you, David, Paul, and Stu, all my best mates. And we're going to go run it, we're going to climb it, and then we're going to swim in a mountain afterwards in the freezing cold.
Where can people go and fund in the page?
Yeah, so if you go on to my Just Giving page, it's just Marcus Elwell, surname spelled E-L-W-E-L-L, so E-L, and you just go on there, Just Giving. So last year I did it, GoFundMe, we raised just under £7,000 in total. And this your donations would be appreciated. I'm up to about 70 kids more and things like that. So they've been through a really tough time, as have I, but I'm a man, I'm a dad, I'm an adult. We can digest it and understand it more. And they've been through a really tough time and I've just tried to put my best foot forward and wanted them to understand that no matter what you go through, you can achieve greatness. We're destined for greatness, all of us. And that's my lad's now gone into senior school, and his end of term assembly for end of year junior school, just back in July, whenever it was, they broke up June. He actually won a very special award, which was, it was the Lover of Life Award. And I just thought, what an amazing award to win. So there was, and the whole year, what they do now, which is better than when we were at school and we didn't have this type of thing, but they'd highlight, so lots of people win awards in this day and age that we live in, and that's, it's all good. And then they highlighted three people in the year that really stood out. So there was two girls, and one was one of fabulous pianists, and she's going to go on to do great things. They were only 11, 10, 11. So she got this accolade because she played at Indies and stuff like this at arenas. And this other girl, for her athletic ability, she was in county for, I think it was running long distance. I can't quite remember. Anyway, just for her athletic ability. And then he just started running off the headmaster ground. So my lad had actually broke his collarbone the last couple of weeks in school, and he wasn't in a lot. So he started talking about it. So when there's this one guy, one pupil in particular, that is just a pleasure to have around. He's always happy. He's always been building people up. He's always encouraging people. He said everybody needs this type of guy in their life, this type of pupil in their life. And I'm thinking, as I'm strapping, I'm thinking, he sounds like Mandela.
Oh.
I'm thinking, do I get my phone and start recording? I'm thinking, no, you don't want to be that guy. I need somebody else. And he just carried on talking about it. And he said, I went into his classroom recently and just said, I said at assembly recently, there's an award that I'm going to give this year, which is called the Lover of Life Award. And he said, and before I'd even finished my pitch, everybody just went, no, hell, well.
Oh, you know, exactly. So he's. Oh, that must have been.
I can't believe I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, so special. Yeah. Especially because they've made an award for him.
It was just amazing. It was just, it was an award that I think had been there, but you got to stand out. And it had been brought into from a family that had lost a pupil or something, and it was there. So it's that they'd done this for people that just love life and just got the best out of it and made the best out of it. And to, again, from where I've been and everything I've been through, to know that the kids have come out stronger and great versions was it's a tick. Because he could have been so different.
Yeah.
I could have reacted so differently, and the operation could have gone differently, and there could have been so many and-ands, and I'm not somebody that looks on the pessimistic side.
No, but it
could have been so different.
And yeah.
It could have been, and it would be very easy to get on the antidepressants after having gone for a brain tumor. It'd be very easy to be the victim after having a brain tumor. Over my burning desire to keep going, and to know that that's actually had an impact on them to the point where my daughter's writing that about me. Last week about homework, about being her inspiration, and my boys getting Lover of Life Award. He then went on to get Most Improved Player and as player in his football. He excelled. He hadn't just survived, he thrived. Mm. And that's my message. If you want to be, don't think because you've had a bad time or because you've had a bad illness that you that's it, because it's not. Don't just think you're going to survive the rest of your remaining days on this planet. Implement this strategy. Find what works for you. I'll give you the free tools. They're out there. They're not rocket science. You don't have to get a fad this, or you don't have to spend any money. So if you're saying to me, I can't afford it, that's not an excuse. If you're saying you can't do it, that's not an excuse, because you just got to sit there and breathe and put cold water on you and meditate. So these things are not the strenuous. They're not out there. They're for you to go and to take and implement them. And you can be not just surviving this planet, but thriving. And being your best you, and just open up new doors, new opportunities, new everything. There's a whole new world out there for you. So my message would be, if you've just recently been diagnosed with brain tumor, if you're surviving one, survive one, or know someone that's gone through it, it's not the end, it's the beginning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.